Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today we'll be talking to the author of The Promise of Participation, Experiments in Participatory Governance in Honduras and Guatemala, Daniel Altshuler. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. Thanks very much for having me.
It was a pleasure to read your book. You've written this book with a co-author. Maybe you can, before we get started on the book, just introduce your co-author first and then a little bit about yourself as well.
Sure. So Javier Corrales is my co-author. He's a professor of political science at Amherst College, and I'm currently a visiting scholar at the Milano School, which is at the New School for Public Engagement.
Great. And you know, before we talk about the substance of the book, there's kind of a unique story about the way this writing collaboration came together. So I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit about how you came to write this book together.
Sure. Well, as it turns out, Javier was actually my undergraduate advisor in political science. And after I left Amherst College as a student, I went and did some research abroad in Chile and in South Africa, looking at issues particularly related to homeless and landless people, but got very interested in civic participation and participation in development and governance initiatives. And when I came back to Amherst to meet with him, I knew that he was looking at similar things in Central America. And so together we decided to work together on this project, which was to examine the effects of participatory governance in the context of community-managed schools in Central America, and in particular in Honduras and Guatemala.
Yeah, before we get to the places where you're doing your study, let's talk a little bit more about participation itself. Well, why participation? You've heard of, refer in the book to a couple of generations of scholarship on this concept. I wonder if you could walk through briefly what we know about participatory governance and what is still unclear. What was the gap that your book fills?
Sure. So first, just definitionally, when we're talking about participatory governance, we're talking about government-led initiatives to solve practical public problems, which include things like education provision, by facilitating participation of ordinary citizens in local forums, and particularly local forums that have some type of important decision-making authority. So school councils, in the context of our research, is what we were talking about. You know, I think since at least the 1960s, there's been a lot of interest in civic participation as a way to improve democracy, first in the context of the literature on participatory democracy, and then that literature sort of ebbed a bit, and instead, or what came next, was a generation of people thinking about participation in international development. And there was some really great literature on this, identifying some of the benefits of that, but also some difficulties when it was particularly tied to isolated development initiatives, when these initiatives were captured by elites, et cetera. More recently, there's been a turn towards participatory governance, you know, in things like participatory budgeting, first in Brazil, and now increasingly in lots of other places in the world. And in all of these generations of scholarship and thinking, there's been this notion of kind of second, what some people refer to as secondary effects, what we refer to as spillover effects, that when you create a forum for participation, it will engender further participation with positive effects on civil society and democracy. And we have seen in the context of participatory governance evidence, for instance, from Brazil, we've seen a lot of examinations of urban participatory governance in Brazil, and found some evidence of improved service delivery, greater equity in service provision, and increased participation within the process of, for instance, participatory budgeting, and some inroads in accountability. What we don't know, or what we think, you know, the gap that we were trying to address, well, there were a few gaps. One was that a lot of that research is urban and doesn't focus on rural areas. Central America is a region of the world that is very untouched by this type of research. We also wanted to test this claim about, does creating this type of participatory space engender participation outside of that arena? So, for instance, if a parent participates in a school council, does it help them to then become, or are they more likely to then participate in other types of organizations? Are they more likely to create an organization or forge alliances with other people? And that's really what we wanted to test and examine through our research.
Yeah, and you know, such pressing questions. Everywhere is has these different institutions that are seeking out what you call the promise of participation. You know, it seems like we really don't know, and I think that's what's so interesting about the book. What's also interesting about the book is where you chose to study. I really like good covers of books, and you have a really interesting photograph on the cover. I wonder if you could talk about your choice of Honduras and Guatemala, maybe in the context of this great photograph that is on the cover of the book.
Sure. Well, hopefully our pretty picture will be sufficient to make people buy the book. You know, I think we chose Honduras and Guatemala. The photograph features a school in a rural area where we did one of our case studies in Honduras. What we know about Guatemala and Honduras are, first of all, they're among the poorest countries in the Americas. They're also, particularly in the case of Honduras, they're radically understudied in the social sciences. We see very little research historically. It's been done on Honduras, perhaps as little, if not less, than any other country in the Americas. So it's a really ripe place to do research. It's also a ripe place for comparative research because you have many small countries on the Central American isthmus with very different political histories. And also, in the case of Honduras and Guatemala, very, some would say weak democracies. As recently as a couple of years ago, in 2009, we had the coup in Honduras. Some researchers have said that type of political instability could also come to Guatemala. And they're really important sites to understand how what types of mechanisms work to promote effective participation and governance. And that's what we wanted to do, particularly in rural areas, which, as I mentioned, are understudied both in Latin America more broadly and in Central America.
And you focus on schools, what you call community-managed schools. So what is a community-managed school exactly? Is this like a private school or a charter school or something very different than what we would recognize in the U.S.?
So they're publicly managed and publicly funded. These are schools that were created throughout Central America. And in Honduras and Guatemala, they were created specifically to address the coverage gap in rural Honduras and Guatemala, where in the 1990s, 25% and 40% of rural school-age children, respectively, lacked primary education access. So they were created to try and build a lot of schools quickly, and thousands were ultimately created. What's distinctive about the model is that parents were given a tremendous amount of autonomy. So parent councils were entrusted with the role of select hiring and firing teachers, as well as monitoring teacher attendance, deciding on certain supplies that they needed to buy, and administering the school.
This really does present such a nice case to study, and you study it with a couple of different methods. You approach this in what would be called a mixed method, using surveys and interviews and such. I wonder if you could describe a little bit about how you approach this. Did you do a lot of the traveling to these locations? You mentioned hiring some research assistants. Was this a big part of the work?
Yeah, it was a really big undertaking, and among the largest of this type of survey and research ever done. And it was cross national, so it was a big. A lot of, I'm going to choose my metaphor carefully, it was a lot of work. We did quantitative and qualitative work. The quantitative work involved a survey that took place in a representative sample of schools across Honduras. And similarly, in Guatemala, we did it across one region, the department or province, with the highest concentration of these schools. And that undertaking took a team of, in each country, roughly 20 surveyors, people who we trained in how to deliver the survey instrument, how to ask parents and complete the questionnaire in the way that they needed to. So that was a very big undertaking that took months, starting in 2007, frankly, because we began with pilots, and then ultimately did the survey with a very large number of parents. And then in addition to that, and Javier and I were on the ground for that, and then in addition to that, we undertook case studies. And that was important to really probe what was going on at the schools. How were parents engaging with them? What was their experience like? How could we understand some of the impacts that we thought we'd uncovered through the survey work? So personally, I spent about a year in Honduras and Guatemala helping to coordinate the quantitative work and then also conducting case studies, aid community case studies. So it was a long process, but a really rich process, and the case studies were critical for really understanding the data and getting a real sense of the context.
Yeah, and so what did you find? I can imagine having done some survey research on my own, you know, the surveys go out and you have, you have hopes and dreams for what you're going to find just as a social scientist, but you also have an investment in the success of the institutions that you're involved with. That must have been somewhat nerve-wracking. Did you end up finding what you expected to find? Were there these effects of the participation that you had hypothesized about?
Well, I think anybody who's ever done quantitative data analysis is familiar with the, like, taking a deep breath before you hit the command function in Stata or whatever statistical program you're using and seeing what you come up with. In our case, you know, I think it was a mixed picture and a nuanced picture. You know, on the one hand, what we saw was we were working in very difficult communities to engage and, you know, where, you know, you had very low socioeconomic levels. There were a lot of barriers to participation and to promoting the type of spillover effects that we were looking for. First, socioeconomic level, but also things education level, but also the fact that the way the programs ended up being run, there was very little support, or there was insufficient support for parents for many parents to learn what they needed to learn. You know, the trainings were infrequent and certainly less frequent in Honduras than in Guatemala, and really focused, the support that was provided was focused on ensuring administrative functionality and less on really promoting participation. We similarly found programs that where political context had a really big impact. So, for instance, patronage in Honduras exerted a very significant influence. So we see, in some ways, the deck stacked against these initiatives creating spillover effects. And yet, what's interesting is that the survey revealed that a majority of parents actually reported some type of skill development or learning. And we saw a non-trivial minority of parents, so more like in the range of 25 to 35% of parents who applied these skills, who participated in additional organizations afterwards, and who demonstrated other types of spillover effects. And so we see that despite the sort of barriers to participation and spillovers that we found, that creating these forums, imperfect as they were, still did promote participation, particularly generating individual spillover effects.
Yeah, and you know, this is one of these situations where it probably isn't necessary for even a majority of people to go on and form their own organizations or be involved. If you can generate change amongst even a minority, that could be a major social change in a community like this. Stepping outside of these two places, what do we make of this in other settings or outside of the educational realm? Are there things that we can learn about this, about the design of participatory institutions that would work for some of the cases you mentioned earlier, budgeting, for instance, or outside of education? What do we make of this? What are the conclusions that we can draw?
Sure. You know, I think there are a lot of conclusions. One of them is that, you know, it's worth investing in participation and trying to figure out how to do it best, with two really important caveats or corollaries. One is that it's critical to understand the political context and how it's going to interact with the initiative that you're creating, whether it's a particular municipality in the state of New York or a province in Latin America. It's critical to know what are the patterns of political representation, how do politics work, and how may they impinge upon or circumscribe or interact with the initiative that you're creating. I think that's really critical as people think about design and think about inserting or working with local people to determine what they're going to create. The other thing, and ideally with as much conversation with folks in that context as possible, the other thing that I think is really critical is simply creating a forum for participation is insufficient, right? So simply saying, okay, you guys can come together and you can have these responsibilities, I think is important and potentially promising. But it's one thing that's really critical, and our research showed, is training is critical. Those parents who receive training were much more likely to demonstrate the type of skills development that we found. They were also more likely, we found an indirect effect where those parents were more likely to demonstrate other types of spillover effects as well. And this resonates with, I think, the work certainly that I've done and that many of my colleagues have done in community participation, whether from an advocate, whether from an advocacy role, an organizing role, or an academic role, which is it really, you can't skimp on that sort of capacity building and training piece. It's really critical, whether it's participatory budgeting in New York City or community managed schools in Central America.
Yeah, and I know you have a day job where you have the opportunity to make some of these things real in the U.S. Is there, following the publication of this book, a publication to follow? Are you working on another book project, or have you been pulled off in too many other directions? What's on the horizon for you?
Well, at present, there is not another book project for me, but certainly Javier is a very prolific author and continues to do his work on Latin American politics. And we hope to continue to be able to collaborate. It was a really exciting project for us. At present, I'm working on issues of civic participation in the United States, focused a lot on immigration politics and thinking about how the immigrant rights movement has evolved and also on the ground involved in organizing efforts to achieve immigration reform and a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants.
Yeah, it's a really interesting book. The title, The Promise of Participation, Experiments in Participatory Governance in Honduras and Guatemala, published by Palgrave Macmillan. I hope that everyone has a chance to read this book and learn something from it. Daniel, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.